Monsters from the Basement.
Hey, this is Ogre from Skinny Puppy, and I'm Pavi in Repo the Genetic Opera, and you have just entered Monsters from the Basement. Enjoy.
Hey everybody, this is James back with another episode of Monsters from the Basement. We are in Atlanta, Georgia at the Days of the Dead convention, and I'm here talking with
Ogre from Skinny Puppy, and I've had a few serendipitous roles in Repo the Genetic Opera, 2001 Maniacs, Field of Screams, and the soon-to-be-released Devil's Carnival with Darren Bousman's new exploration into the Aesop's fables and Carnival of the Souls, so to say.
Really, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's coming out. I think it's coming here in Atlanta next month, April 18th at the Plaza Theater. And I'm not sure if you're from. You're not from Atlanta, are you? Right?
We're from Tennessee.
Might be going to Tennessee too. I don't know all the stops, but they're like doing a road show, kind of like a Carney road show. It's based on Aesop's fables in a way, and the idea that people that are going through their transgressions in life have to deal with the devil at the end, so they come to the devil's carnival before they're judged and passed on to hell, and are kind of forced to deal with their own mirror reflections. And I play a character called the Twin, which is basically an empath, sort of snake-like character, shifty, a shill, serpentine, who takes on the characteristics and the physical appearance of anybody he comes in contact with in order to show them themselves.
Was Skinny Puppy the first band you were in?
Yeah, Skinny Puppy was my first band. I think before that I was kind of a feckless 21-year-old. My father died when I was 19 from prostate cancer, advanced prostate cancer. So I was kind of running from the devil in a lot of ways in my own mind, thinking my family, I died. A number of family members passed away in a really short amount of time right after that. So I kind of was feckless and moved to Vancouver from Calgary and discovered kind of a kind of an alternate way of living, and kind of just went headlong into it with these group of people and made some very close bonds with some people, you know, that made music. And then we started doing Skinny Puppy as more of a four-track in-home project, and then met Dave Ogilvie as our producer, took us into the studio, and we recorded an album, thinking it was going to be one album only. It was so kind of left of center. And I thought it would just be a great experience. Like, I've made one record, you know, what a great thing. But it somehow extended itself until we're still making records 27 years later, almost 30 years later now, actually.
Yeah. So when did you first form the band?
1983, yeah.
Still going strong, huh?
Still going, yeah, fairly strong. We're like have a really good strong following in Europe. Here, you know, we've gone through, obviously, a number of different kind of ebbs and flows and waves, and it's still, you know, we've always been a working band. You know, we've never really, you know, crossed the boundary of being you know, the top 1%, the top 2% that make the big money, that make the you know, the house payments and the multiple cars. It's we've always been a working band, and I think because of our political nature, we've never really taken any corporate sponsorships or anything like that either. So I'm kind of proud of that, and at the same time, you know, if I could go back and do it again, would I do it the same way? Probably, but at the same time, I'd, you know, maybe look at things differently as well.
Now, how did you get involved with Repo?
Repo, I got involved with Joe Bishara, who produced the music. He was a friend of mine in bands when we were starting Skinny Puppy. And I was coming off a Skinny Puppy tour, and he came to our show in L.A. and said, "What are you doing now? Or what do you want to do now?" And I said, "Well, you know, one of my big dreams is," I had no idea he was working even in film, and although I knew he was doing some soundtrack work. And I said, "One of the things I want to do is be under prosthetics and in a makeup." And he goes, "Well, I have a friend who's doing this movie, Darren Bousman, doing a movie called Repo the Genetic Opera, and they haven't cast one of the characters yet, and you might be good for it." So I had auditioned a number of years before in the 90s for The Crow, Jim O'Barr's The Crow, with the original Crow as Fun Boy. Had a horrible audition and thought that I wasn't really set up to make the switch from stage to a small sort of intimate setting and doing things behind camera. So I had a horrible experience, and so when I had this experience, I went and met them. They kind of more wanted they wanted actors that could sing, not singers that could act. So it was a bit of a battle, but everybody within the production, Terrence, Darren, you know, all, Darren Smith, they're really into the idea of me, but they had to sell me to the studio. And the studio was looking for a whole different character there. They were thinking of Newman from Seinfeld as a character of Pavi at first, you know. And then, of course, Jay was Pavi in the short film they did to like muster up money for the film. So I was lucky. I guess what got it for me was I went out and really studied the part, you know, really kind of went into detail on who I thought Pavi was. And I did a character analysis and went and did the audition, and I had an amazing audition. And so I left that audition literally like Mary Tyler Moore, you know, throwing up my hat on the street, just because I honestly didn't care that if I got the part at that point. I just had a really good audition, which I'd never had experienced before. And it was kind of a funny thing. I did something where in my mirror, I have a mirror that's a narcissist, and in my mirror I had a picture. I didn't tell anybody, but I had a picture, and I won't tell you who, but when I went for my audition, I knew that there was a few other people auditioning for Amber Sweet, and Paris was one of them. And the night that I went in, it was in a studio, and I was sitting out in the waiting room, kind of a hallway in between the studio and the outside doors, and so I was in a big commotion. I'm sitting there practicing my lines with my mirror, with the mirror down, practicing my lines in my head. All of a sudden, there's a big kerfuffle, the doors open, and Paris Hilton walks out. And she comes by, hi, bye, you know, da, 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 goes out the doors, flash bulbs going off outside the paparazzi. I'm just like, whoa, okay, do I do this? So I went in, and my whole shtick was like, you know, at the end of it, I was saying to Darren, I was saying, you want to know who Pavi is? You want to know who fucking Pavi is? This is Pavi. And I showed my mirror, and on the mirror, I taped a picture of Paris. Right, and then everybody, you know, erupted in laughter, and so that was kind of, you know, I had a really good audition. I left thinking whether I get the role or not, I don't care, and I ended up getting the role. So.
Now that movie's kind of taken on a Rocky Horror type of cult status, hasn't it?
Yep, I think it has. I think it's working its way towards that. I mean, they actually tried to market it at first as an instant cult classic, and I think that, you know, I think they had a right to say it, but I think it kind of worked against them in the press. I think that, you know, they and that was critics that said that, but I think it was a little premature in a lot of people's minds. But I think as well, and those people that judged it as being too premature, I think they were a little off, because I think it did instantly. And I think what Darren did with it, by taking it on the road and actually, you know, running it through a bunch of cities and like doing the work, he really did the groundwork to make it into something that could become a cult classic very easily. And now now it's got legs because of all the work that he's done on it, for sure. I mean, he really championed that film, because he really went up against Goliath, you know, to like make that film happen with Lionsgate, because Lionsgate didn't know what to do with it. They kind of wanted to bury it, you know, because one of the producers kind of left Lionsgate, Peter Block. It's a whole kind of Shakespearean, you know, or Roman Senate tragedy in a lot of ways. You know, it's strange. And so I watched just how hard he fought to get that film to happen. It was literally by, you know, tooth and nail, just going out and doing it and beating the streets that he got it going. So, you know, so I benefit from all that groundwork, I guess.
I know you do several conventions a year. You enjoy doing those?
I really do. I actually thought I did. I'm a bit of an introvert, or I was. When I was younger, I was a complete introvert. So music was something that kind of took me out of one element. And then, you know, doing film kind of was another stage of breaking that bubble a little bit. And then coming to these things, you know, again, I spend a lot of time behind a computer writing music. You're in your head too much. I live up on a mountain outside of LA, so I'm very kind of removed from everything. So coming out and doing these things is actually, at first, I was also a little strange, but I've never really charged for autographs. You know, I've always signed in music for free. I went to Comic-Con for the first time with Repo. I was jumping over tables, signing things for people, doing everything. And at the end, on the next day, on the pages, they were like, oh, Ogre came to his first convention, but he didn't bring anything. And I was like, okay, I get it. So I came out and brought some stuff, and you know, started kind of talking to people, and it's a great interaction. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And everybody at these conventions are incredibly nice. Like, they're, you know, monster people are the nicest people, and I've always known that, because I grew up with Forrest J. Ackerman and Famous Monsters of Filmland, and we were actually part of the Bat Pack. I don't know if you know. You obviously know Famous Monsters, right?
Yeah.
Well, we were part of his, Jomo, who's doing Mad Monster Party next week, who you'll meet, I'll introduce you to him, was his caretaker, and one of my best friends. And we were all part of the Bat Pack, who went over to Forrest's place on Friday night. We clean up the house for the Saturday tour every weekend, and when Dane died, we you know, he kind of went into a depression and became almost a hoarder. And so we went through and cleaned out his entire place. We did a Karloff Lugosi room. We did a Chaney room. And just brought the house back up to where people could come through and walk through it again. And we're with him to the end of his life. So that's kind of my, you know, I used to come to these conventions as a fan. So being here is a great thing, and again, just being able to talk to people. I mean, Monster people are the best people. They're just the kindest, nicest people. So
Thor is one of my heroes. I have a picture of him hanging in my den.
A wonderful man. I mean, I was very lucky. I moved to L.A. in 1991. Met Jomo and Sean Fernald, who were two Monster kids who knew Forey and were already kind of part of the Bat Pack. We were called the Bat Pack. And my first visit over there, again, I'd read Famous Monsters back from when I was in the 70s. You know, wanted all the back issues and, you know, all that stuff. And being able to go to his house and be able to go through things, you know, touch the Brontosaurus, the Marcel Delgado Brontosaurus from King Kong, play with the Harryhausen things, the Emir, you know, all of my fan, you know, and boxes of stuff that you dig through and you'd find ephemera, a letter from Bela Lugosi, you know, blueprints from Fritz Lang for a movie that was never produced for set designs. It was just all this stuff that we found for him. Unfortunately, for a lawsuit he had to go into, which I'm sure you heard about with Ray Ferry, to just try and get him out of that. And we ended up moving him into a smaller house and cleaned out his house and were with him right to the end. But I knew him more as a person. I love the stuff, but I'm not a collector. And I loved him more than anything. He was an incredible person who never thought he had anything worth to say. That's why he had all of that stuff. He didn't realize, even till the end of his life, that people were coming to the house to see him. Not to see the stuff too, but they're coming to see his stories and hear, you know, I've read every single one of these books, every single last word in these books on this one, my library. And then he opens it up, see, opens the last page, there you go. All those stories, you know, are just things that I miss him so dearly, you know. And I mean, going down there every weekend for us was just an amazing thing to be able to do, you know. And just little verklempt there, you know. I definitely miss him. I flash back to the memorial. Did you go to the memorial, though? The last thing was just him, a little kind of, you know, picture of him saying, you know, up, up and away, 4EJ. And, you know, that was it, you know, and then it was all gone. But to have the memory of being able to go through all that stuff was amazing, you know. It was just absolutely amazing. Like going through files and finding the original press clips from, like, Rosemary's Baby and all, you know, it was just stuff like that was amazing. The ephemera was incredible. So, sorry, I digress.
Now, when you look back over the stuff you've done in your career, what are you most thankful for?
Well, I'm really thankful that, you know, I took a chance to kind of step outside of what I was scared of. And I was a very insecure person when I was young. And, you know, we all have family issues. We all have things that we, you know, scars that we bear and things that we bear. But I think just the fact that for some reason I had the gumption to kind of push through those paper walls, you know, and see that there's just a big world out there that's totally accessible to me. And anything is possible. Like, all of my dreams have kind of come true in a weird way. Whether it was, you know, when I was 5 years old, sitting there listening to the AM radio going, wouldn't it be great to sit in a studio and sing a song? Well, I got that. And then I had the same thing about being in makeup. I loved Chambers. I loved the Apes. I loved when they started doing foam appliances. And I was like, I'd read articles about people, actors bitching about having to get up so early to get into the makeup chair by 5 in the morning. And suddenly I found myself in Toronto at 3:30. I was up, you know, waiting for the car to pick me up, not because I'm special, but for liability and take me down. And I was in a makeup chair at 5 o'clock, you know, getting Pavi put on my face. So it's things like that. You know, if you just believe in it and you keep positively thinking about it, you'll have that experience. Whatever it is, it might not be what you think it is, but you'll have it. You know, I truly believe that.
I know you've met your number one fan here this weekend.
That's right. Erin's my number one fan. Absolutely. She's a sweetheart. You know, you guys have a wonderful family, and thank you.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time this morning and talking with me.
You bet. Hi, Erin.
And wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you very much, sir, and thanks for this.